everyone, and welcome to episode 34 of season 11 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is J-Dub from Dubsism. Welcome back to the show, John.
Hey, Rob. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to trying to find a way to float my back teeth, but we'll get there.
a helmet full of army coffee is a good place to start.
That is very true. Very true. It shows you did your homework also.
Well, and in the previous episode, we did reveal that we are both veterans of various and sundry things. So,
yes, that's true. That's very true. So, episode 34 begins with Moore telling more tall tales and ends with Winters basically cautioning Welsh's suspicions. So, we ended things yesterday with the men talking about spears, debating whether this is, truth or fiction, everything that's been happening. Mm-hmm. And today Moore continues with his story, and he goes, well, all I know from what I heard, he took the last 105 on D-Day practically by himself, riding through machine gun fire like a maniac. Now, anyone who's seen the second part of this miniseries knows that he didn't take it by himself, but he was leading the pack. You know, everyone else is running mm-hmm. through the trenches, and he just jumps out of the trench and runs through. So, and Malarkey was there. So Malarkey goes, yeah, that I did see. On his own? Yep. And then Moore goes, I don't care if any of the other stuff's true. So it's funny that he's basically saying, you've just proven to me that this guy is a hero, so I don't care if he did some bad things also. The fact that he was able to take out that 105 on his own, that's what's important, so mm-hmm. it's an interesting perspective about the whole thing. So I like it.
And then, again, it's like, the theme that we had in the last time we talked is that there's that how that scuttlebutt thing, or bullshit, how they, it rattles around and takes on a life of its own, and it just, again comes down to, like he says it for himself, I don't care if any of the other stuff is true, you believe what you want to believe, just like you said.
Exactly. But he's my interpretation of that is he's saying this story that I just said that Malarkey confirmed, to me that's all I need to know. If that's true, then I don't care about anything else.
Believes what he wants to.
That's right. And again, that's something that is known, that Spears did take that 105 pretty much, or he led the assault on the 105. That type of thing. And then Moore turns to Blythe and goes, hey, Albert. He goes, what do you think? And now I find it really interesting that these you have five guys that are here. They're having a conversation. Four of them are talking, and the fifth one's just listening and not saying anything. And finally, someone just brings him into the conversation, which I guess is nice from Moore's perspective, the way that he's doing that. So I like this whole part three is very focused on Blythe, so it makes sense for them to add Blythe into the bring him into the fold with this whole thing. And Blythe just says, well, I don't know. I'm just going to take everyone's word for it. He goes, I didn't see any of it. And then Welsh shows up. He wants to get the men ready. And he goes, let's go, first platoon. Weapons on me. We're moving out. So the guys all get up and they start gathering up their supplies and everything they got. And, one of them goes, hey, take all your smokes. And then Musk goes, on your feet. Tactical column. Flankers up. And then he goes, That means you, Private Blythe. And then one of the other guys turns to Blythe and goes, come on, Blythe, get up. So, I mean, it's again, it's interesting that Welsh is singling out Blythe. I guess he's singling him out because, you know, he's the only one who's lying there sunning himself while everyone else is moving around, I guess. Maybe it's just to make an example out of him that, you know, this is a, you know, everyone else is moving. We're not on vacation here. You know, that type of thing.
Well, you know, you can say this, whether it's military, not the military, wherever. You pick any group of more than 7 or 8 people that have to work together, and there's always that one who just isn't part of the herd. You know what I mean?
That's right.
It doesn't matter where or what. There's always that guy or that woman or that whoever. It's just, that's just human nature.
That's true. But again, what's interesting is the fact that you know, the guys just included Blythe in this conversation, and right after they include him, conversation's over. he's got nothing to really add to the situation, and then okay, let's you know, hey Blythe, get up. You know, that type of thing. So, you know, it's nicely done. And, you know, as the men are getting ready, the scene changes. And we then see from a far distance the men walking through like a field in formation. And you can see that this is more than just one platoon. There's a lot of them there. This could be the entire Easy Company that's walking. And it's a great shot because you can see it from a distance. I mean, to me, they do look like they might be a little too close to one another when, you know, you sort of need to space yourself out a little more than it seems that they do. But there isn't much we can do about that. I guess they just need to get them in the frame, you know, and that's it. And they're like, no one's going to notice, you know, that these guys are too closely clumped together. Who's going to be looking at this?
Or freeze frame it and count them.
Who's going to be doing this 25 years from now? You know, watching this entire miniseries and debating everything that's going on, you know, 5 minutes at a time. That's not going to happen. Come on.
And then worse yet, you know, recording it so other people have to suffer it. I mean, yeah.
Nobody has to suffer it. If you don't want to listen, you don't listen. if anything has to suffer, the people have to suffer listening, you know, to my guest. Remember, they come.
That's probably far more.
People come back to listen to me and have my, you know, to my conversations with my guests. But you know, if they don't like a particular,
well, you are the star of the show.
I am the anchor of the show. I would say I wouldn't call myself a star.
You're Johnny Carson, and I'm not even Ed McMahon. I'm the guy who's at the end of the couch by the end of the show. You know.
But I still like having you on. It's fine. Yeah. Stop trying to belittle yourself. My point is that I'm sure that there are people who will say, oh, I don't want to listen to that guest. But someone who's listening to my show will constantly apparently want to listen to me, which is great. Which is, you know, why I'm still here after more than 1,200 episodes. So why not?
Absolutely.
And then the shot focuses in on some of the guys, and Percanti goes, hey, Luz, how far are we going? He goes, oh, Jesus Christ, Frank, I don't know. Until they tell us to stop. So, I mean, it's a great little banter between the two of them as they're doing this. And as they're talking, you see that it looks like it's starting to rain a little bit. There's like a little bit of drizzle coming down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's just, showing their winning.
That feeling that, you know, it's showing a lot, but it's also that whole scene, you feel like something else is about to happen here.
That's true. And then one of the other guys goes, high ground. There's high ground up ahead, which is sort of also, it goes with what you're saying, that they're preparing us that something is going to happen. And then Percanti says to Luz, all right, genius, answer me this then. Why is Easy Company the only company who's either at the front of the advance or, like now, exposed at the far edge of the line? And the response that he gets is, to keep you on your toes. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that we're never in the middle, and we're the fifth of 9 companies of this regiment. Able through item, think of it. And then he goes, see there? See that? And I like the fact that this character who, you know, unfortunately I can't remember his name. I can't place him right now. But the way he's looking at all this stuff is he notices that there's something, that they're coming up to a place that has high ground. And usually when someone has high ground, it means that you're about to get ambushed. So they're sort of, you know, alluding and hinting to things here. And obviously their discussion gets cut off by the gunfire. And everyone starts jumping for cover. Yeah. And then Welsh goes, incoming, contact right, get in the hedgerow. And then the same soldier goes, see what I mean? You know, again, showing that he understood that that's the place where, you know, it's possible they were going to be getting ambushed from. And then Welsh goes, left, bring it around. And then we hear gunshots, and one of the guys starts running, and we see that he gets shot as he's running for cover. And then Welsh screams, stay low. And he goes, Luz, get down here with the radio now. And we see Blythe that, you know, he takes cover and, you know, that doesn't really do much. As he's not even like holding his rifle or anything like that at this point. You know, he's like a sort of a little bit in shock as to what's going on, but he's found a place where he feels that that he's safe and doesn't need to worry about he's crouching, he's grasping his rifle, but he's not holding it in a position where he's actually going to be able to effectively use it, which you want to be able to shoot if you need to.
It is sort of the point. Yes.
And you know, we get to hear his constant heavy breathing, you know, from all the excitement and adrenaline that's going on here. And then the shot changes and it's now night, and we hear soldiers singing, and we still see Blythe more or less in the same spot, even though, you know, as we're going to explain shortly, there's no way that he's still in the same spot, but it looks as if he's in the same spot. And then we hear the thunder, and we hear a little bit of rain coming down, and then we hear a bunch of German soldiers singing. And at this point, you know, we see that Blythe is near a foxhole with Sergeant Martin. And Martin goes, what have they got to sing about? Which is a great line. We're in the middle of a battle. Why are these guys singing? And then he hears something.
Well, yeah, it seems to be a valid question.
And then he hears something rustling nearby, and he goes, flash. And, you know, he gets ready for someone to show up. And then Welsh shows up and says, thunder. And then Welsh listens to the music for a second. And he goes, catchy tune, ain't it? And then Martin goes, hey, Lieutenant, what's the news? And then Welsh says to him, oh, same as it was this afternoon. They're in their hedgerow. We're in ours. And then he goes, spell me a minute, sir. So what does that phrase mean? What does it mean, spell me? When I think of it, I think of riddle me.
Spell me?
The Riddler. Riddle me this. You know. But here it's spell me.
Well, spell me is actually that comes from, at least to my knowledge, comes from the world of sports, where it just really kind of means, you know, take over for me, pick me up, help me out, spell me, you know, be me for a second, essentially.
Okay. I mean, it's definitely the way that you can describe that also. What it more or less means, though, is that the idea of spell me is to allow someone to rest briefly by taking their place in an activity. So it's basically take a little brief rest, you know, that type of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Which makes sense. And
well, especially if you're back.
Exactly. Floating. And then and then Welsh says, are you going to let Blythe get some sack time? And he goes, my back teeth are floating. And, you know, I've actually never paid any attention to this term beforehand. You know, for me, this was, you know, as many times as I've seen Band of Brothers, I've never thought about this particular phrase. Bottom line is that it means something completely different than what I was thinking of. So I'm going to first allow you to tell us what it means, and then I'll go into a little more detail.
Back teeth are floating?
Nope.
You didn't know what that
never
meant.
Never heard that phrase
before. Oh, okay, well, back teeth are floating just means that you are at the I am gonna wet my pants stage of needing to
Okay.
relieve yourself.
Again, that's a very fair thing for someone have to need. especially when you're in
Exactly.
a when you're in a foxhole. You don't really want to relieve yourself in the foxhole.
Yes, because the reason why you're in the foxhole is if you stand up, you're going to get shot. So,
That's right.
you know.
But again, you also don't want to do it in the foxhole.
No, that's not good either.
So the
It's just the
that's right.
trade-offs we have to make.
So basically, the phrase "my back teeth are floating" has two main meanings. It's an informal slang phrase for needing to urinate urgently, or a serious dental medical term for teeth that appear loose and unanchored due to bone loss from conditions like advanced gum disease or rare tumors. So I guess.
I have never heard that used as a
Well,
term
I
for
again, I'm not a
dentistry.
dentist, and I, you know, like most people, I try and avoid going to the dentist. So, but again, I think
Fair. I just I've
I think
never
the
heard that
slang
before.
meaning is a little better.
Well, and it's the one that we understood, but I mean the dentist one makes sense too. I just that's a new one. I have learned something today.
Well, why not? Isn't that why you come here? Don't you come here to get a little bit of
Oh,
an
absolutely.
education?
Yes. I mean, you know, amongst several other reasons, but yes, the education is definitely part of the overall Movie Rob
There you
benefit
go.
package.
That's great. It definitely makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It's pretty much assumed that this is a phrase that came from the Deep South.
That would make total sense, yes.
Yeah, it is known as a Southernism. It's part of hillbilly slang.
Like hillbilly, like Appalachia, or because hillbilly can mean a lot of different things.
Right.
There's a lot of flavors of hillbillies.
That's true. So I mean, what it says here is that it's a Southernish saying meaning I need to pee very badly, which makes me wonder why Forrest Gump had to say I need to pee instead of just saying my back teeth are floating. That would have been more interesting for him to say that to JFK. Then I got
Except
to
there would have been a lot of people who just thought he needed to see a dentist, apparently.
apparently it's true. it's mostly known as I guess rural talk,
Well, yeah, I
right?
mean, southern and rural kind of go together.
Usually, yeah. And the expression actually only goes back to the mid 20th century, which means wasn't that long before that this series takes place that this happens. And it likely began as a humorous exaggeration of having a full bladder, so full it might make your molars float. It's the idea that I am so full that I can even feel it in my throat, in my back teeth, that I really got to go.
And the phrase probably didn't become popular until the 20s because dentistry in the South had to advance to the point where people still had teeth beyond the age of, say, 14, you know?
That's true. That's very true. So yeah, it's it fits in with the South. From that perspective. So yeah. And I mean, obviously, Welsh also knows what they're talking about by responding to this. He goes, "Well, get back here ASAP, Martin." And he goes, "Count on me, sir." And then Welsh then slides into the foxhole with Blythe, and he goes, "How you doing, Blythe?" "I'm okay, sir." And then Welsh asks him, "What happened at the aid station today?" And he goes, "Doc Rowe, he called it hysterical blindness." And as Blythe is talking, so Welsh offers him his canteen. He goes, No, thank you, sir." And Welsh goes, "You know what they said in basic? Dehydration is a soldier's worst enemy." And he chuckles a little bit to himself, and he goes, "It's a game, Blythe. That's all. Hell, we're just moving the ball forward 1 yard at a time. Nothing but a game." He goes, "What is, sir?" Yes, the whole thing. And once again, he tries to give him the canteen. He goes, no, thank you, sir. Well, she goes, just the game. So I obviously, you know, my impression when they say it's a, you know, moving the ball forward 1 yard at a time, obviously must be referring to football. And that's probably your thing. That's probably your segue, you know, for you to talk about your daily sports analogy.
You know, in the last episode, we played the Groucho Marx game, say the secret word, win $1 million. You're dead on. I mean, it's so obvious here that yes, that phrase clearly comes from football, and that was the whole point of the sports analogy, because what he's really talking about when you talk about moving the ball 1 yard at a time is that there's an old saying that when you have third down, fourth down, short yardage, you know, you have to get, you know, a yard or less to get what you need to do more often than not actually win the game. And it's just, you know, if you can't get that one hard yard when you need it, you don't deserve to win. And that's really what the underpinning of that phrase is, that sentence is. And if you played football, you knew that. If you watched any of this show up to this point, you figured that out too, maybe in a different way. But you know, an infantryman and a football player, especially a lineman, they got a lot in common. There's a lot of, you know, that's why the term in football is, you know, fighting in the trenches. I mean, there's a reason why football terminology and war terminology cross over as much as they do. And when you see, you know, him say that line in this situation, and in the context of knowing what we're going to talk about, and in the context of knowing that, hey, this is probably what his sports analogy is going to be, it just seems really, really clear that that's what we were going to have to talk about.
Yeah, of course. You see, I apparently randomly chose these episodes for you to be on because I randomly did not know that there was a football analogy here. So it's fate.
Well, you know, and again, it's why these things work. And again, if we talk about something I said at the end of the last episode where we said the part of the storytelling here is relatability. Well, again, here's another example of here's, you know, two guys whose backgrounds are, you know, somewhat significantly different, watching the same 5 minutes of a show, looking at that line and immediately understanding that is something that's important, and it's going to carry a theme later on, because, well, you know, there's a lot of hard yards coming for these guys.
Yeah, that's true. And again, part of the whole idea is, you know, just moving a little bit at a time, you know, that obviously that's the job of an infantryman. You know, you can't take ground without having men on boots on the ground, as they say.
You know? Absolutely. That's 100%
that,
true.
That's what you do. You move yard by yard in order to do. But it's interesting that Welsh basically is calling this a game, you know, but I guess that's what you got to do in order to win the game. You got to, as you said, you gotta get the ball over the finish line.
There's a lot of foreshadowing in that moment, but you know, we will be getting to that shortly.
Yes, exactly. A shadow that comes from the side, and Winter shows up, and he goes, "Harry." At this point, Welsh, you know, comes with him. You know, gets out of the foxhole, starts talking to him, and he goes, S2 says the Germans only left the company to defend Carrington. He goes, yeah, the rest pulled out sometime last night. And then Welsh goes, I knew that town was too easy. Then Winter says to him, yeah. So again, they're confirming for us here also. I mean, we obviously at the beginning of this week, we dealt with the battle itself, you know, that they the first part of the battle that they went through in Carrington. So, you know, after they retreated from that, the Germans, there weren't that many Germans that stuck around either. So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, they're giving us a little bit of exposition in between in order to help us get a better understanding of what's going to happen here. Because again, there's so much information that they have to try and get us throughout this entire series. Because again, it takes place over a year basically. So
true.
But I like the way they do it. I think it's very effective.
For me, the big thing I got out of this whole chunk was that if you take, we mentioned that there are several characters who have, shall we say, intriguing stories to them that you may not know, but you are curious about. Blythe was the first one in terms of these segments. Where, if you think about it in terms of a horse race, you have all those characters that you think may have more interesting backstory than might originally appear, and they're finding ways to keep you interested in that. Well, Blythe was the leader right out of the gate. But in this segment, the lieutenant passes him for a lot of reasons. And the big one was something you just kind of alluded to when he's talking about, the hard yard thing, because that's your first clue that, okay, he knows what's coming for these guys. And then the second thing about it's just a game, and it's like that's a phrase you've heard come out of every grizzled old veteran sergeant, not just in movies, but in the real world. That it's just a game thing is that's a guy that's been in the military a long time, and he's seen a lot of stuff, and it does something to those guys that a lot of people just really don't understand. And that scene, really, you start to see it in him. And then you put in that in your head with the scuttlebutt that was, going on before about, what did he actually do, and, who wants to believe what about what he actually did. And that just really puts a big stamp on, yeah, this guy's been through something, and we're about to find out what.
Exactly. We're going to have to wait until tomorrow to possibly know that information. We're just going to have to wait. It's a waiting game.
And that's why we call that a segue, kids.
Exactly. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about with this 5-minute segment?
No, that covers it for me.
All right. So now we will play today's segment, which is World War II movie trivia.
I've got my buzzer ready,
give
Chuck.
You, five movie trivia questions. We'll see. We'll see how well you know World War II movies. So let's spin the wheel and see what we get. What random question we're going to get. Okay. Who plays the title character in the 1968 movie, The Secret War of Harry Frigg?
Oh, wow. Right away, you hit me one that I've not seen. 68. Is this an American film or a British film? American film, 68. Boy, this is a stupid guess, but for some reason, this guy's popping into my head, so I'm going with it. Robert Ryan.
No. Nice try. But it's...
I'm not even close.
No. So let's see what type of hint I can give you for this one. Okay, he was married to Joanne Woodward. How's that?
Paul Newman?
Yes, very good.
Wow. Okay.
It's actually a movie that I saw for the first time in the last year. It's interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say that clearly didn't get on my radar.
Yeah, it's a movie about there's a whole bunch of generals from the Allies that are taken prisoner by the Germans, and they send in an escape artist to get captured so that he can find a way to help them escape. Again, it's an interesting idea.
Okay. You say this was 68?
Yeah, 1968. The Secret War of Harry Frigg.
Hey, that escape movie from 63 did pretty well. Let's make something like that. But we need a gimmick.
There are a lot of them. Trust
I know.
Me. All right. So let's spin the wheel again and see what your next question will be. Okay. I got to tell you that you almost got that escape movie that you just talked about.
Almost?
Almost. It was the next one. And this one was just on the cusp. in the spin of the wheel.
Okay.
So, okay. Who plays the lead character in the 2006 film The Good German?
Hmm. Okay, so my wife is going to tell you that if you pick a, her joke is, if it was a movie made after 1980, you never heard of it, because I don't watch a lot of new movies. So again, I'm going to plead ignorance, and I'm going to go right to the movie Rob hint.
The movie Rob hint.
Yes.
Sorry, I think you said the movie Rob hint.
No. That seems a little severe for not having seen a movie, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's true. It was directed by Steven Soderbergh. Does that help you? And it's the main star is one of the actors that he quite often used.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Okay, he won an Oscar in 2000 for playing a spy. Even best supporting actor.
Best supporting actor for playing a spy.
Or maybe it was 2005.
What was the movie?
Yes, 2005. Sorry, the movie was in 2005.
What
he won the Oscar.
What was the movie?
Syriana.
Oh, yeah. No, I got nothing.
Okay, he was known for many years as the most eligible Hollywood bachelor until he got married about 10 years ago, I guess.
God damn it. I should have said George Clooney on the last hint, shouldn't I?
Yes, you should.
Yeah, I wanted to, but I wasn't sure, but, you know. So, yeah.
Got it.
George
Clooney. Okay, yes. George Clooney, very good. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Let's spin the wheel for your next question. And around and around and around the wheel goes. Okay, in the 1989 film Fat Man and Little Boy, what is the name of the B-29 bomber that dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima in the 1945 attack?
The first aircraft was named Enola Gay.
Very good. See, there you go. And that's after 1980, so, you know, you still...
It is after 1980, and you just happened to pick a movie I saw, so that's lightning in a bottle twice right there.
Perfect. All right, there you go. Let's spin the wheel again and hope you get something that's as simple for you as can be. Okay. In the 1970 film Kelly's Hero, what is the name of Don Rickles' character?
Oh, God damn it.
That's before 1980.
It is, and I love Don Rickles. And Sergeant? Oh, yeah. No, I can't believe I can't remember that name, but I can't.
I don't even know how to give you a hint on this one.
I know, it's going to be one of those things where I go like, oh, that was it. I knew it. Just like the George Clooney thing. Like, it's going to be one of those things where like, yeah, I knew that, but I couldn't pull it up.
Yeah, no, I'm just trying to think of a hint that I can try and give you for this one. Because it's such a great and unique name that you would never think of, that someone would be called that. Okay, it's something that people play in Vegas.
Your game show is morphing into Password here. It's not craps.
It is.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay.
He's called Crap Game.
Crap Game.
Yes.
That's a rim shot. All right. But I still had to be prompted, so it's half a rim shot.
Okay, fine. So let's spin the wheel for your final question. Okay, who played the title character in the 2014 movie The Imitation Game?
So, again, the 1980 rule is in play. The Imitation Game.
The character he plays is Alan Turing.
I'm going to give you another George Clooney type answer. It's not Benedict Cumberbatch, is it?
Of course it is. You see, there you go. You did a very nice job there.
I must be the league leader in hints, though, because I'm taking a couple of those pretty deep.
That's fine.
Yeah, I didn't recall seeing a scoreboard, so all right.
All right, so now we will play the daily game of name that World War II movie. So we're going to once again go and spin the wheel and see what movie you have to try and guess. Who knows? Maybe it'll be one of the movies that we've already talked about in the trivia game. It is possible. So let's spin the wheel and see what you get.
Being something that we've already talked about, then is basically how I passed Psych 101 in college. That could be a story for another time.
Okay, this is a film from 1942.
Okay.
All right. So therefore, it is before 1980, and it's about a group of Polish actors who, after the invasion of Poland, need to find a way to trick the Germans into helping them, into letting them escape. It was remade in 1983. I know that's beyond your, and I gotta say this.
When it was
the main character's name is Joe Turow, who was a previous guest on earlier episodes in the first week of this, or in the second week of this season. But, you know, the famous Polish actor, Joseph Turow. I just got to say that.
Okay, so when this was remade in 1983, was it remade with its original title?
Yes, the exact same title.
Who starred in the 83 remake?
Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks?
Yes, he also directed it. The title is from Shakespeare.
Oh, God, this is another one. To be or not to be.
Exactly. Very good. Nicely done, nicely done.
The Mel Brooks thing completely threw me. I was like, yeah, okay. So you smoked that one by me.
The original one's with Jack Benny. It's hilarious, you know. And to me, what makes it even funnier is the fact that it was made during World War II, where they're making fun of Hitler. You know, similar to what Chaplin did, you know, in The Great Dictator.
Yeah. Well, it was fashionable then.
Apparently. All right. So would you like to tell people where they can find J-Dub?
J-Dub, you can find me at dubsism.com, the world's most interesting independent sports blog on the web. It's D-U-B-S-I-S-M. You can see me on Facebook, Instagram, X, the usual suspects. Like I said, D-U-B-S-I-S-M. First page search result on Google.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. J-Dub, you feel like coming back again tomorrow on Friday the 13th to continue talking about this? I mean, we might get some things that Jason would do on Friday the 13th on tomorrow's episode. You never know.
Well, I'm not superstitious, and I can easily be heavily armed, so bring on Jason.
All right. Excellent. So, until tomorrow, Curry!
Curry!